Sunshine Meets on Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8.
A very good evening and welcome to Sunshine Meets. For the next hour, my special guest is former Taoiseach Bertie Ahern. Bertie, good evening.
Good evening to you, and very nice to be on.
Now, I suppose in an hour we'll never cover all your life. I want to go back to the very, very beginning, and I want you to tell me a little bit about, you know, where you're from, your early life, your family, and Dublin as it was in, around the time you were sort of growing up.
Well, I was born and reared in Drumcondra and still live in it. My mum and dad were from Cork, but came to Dublin in the end of the 20s. And settled in Drumcondra. They both, my dad and mum, lived in just off Hollybank Road, Glenarm Avenue. So they didn't move far, one side of the Tolka to the other. And my father went working in All Hallows College in the early 30s. And my mum had been doing children's nursing. She was back and forward to Isle of Man and working around town. And they married and had six kids. One died as a baby. Lived in Church Avenue in Drumcondra all her life. Still, one of my brother's children has it now. So we were all brought up very much in Drumcondra. We're all very much Drumcondra people. People who would be listening, All Hallows College was on one side of us, Pat's College, which was the DCU nowadays, but was for 100 years the training school for teachers. So we were lucky in that there was land all around us. And we were very lucky because in those days, All Hallows was thriving. It was the seminary for, run by the Vincentian Order, but the seminary for the foreign missions. So we had great facilities, great sporting facilities. So our playground was All Hallows College. We had the GAA pitches and the soccer pitches and the gyms and the tennis courts when there wasn't none around the place. So it was a great place to be brought up. My dad was farm manager. So we all had our chores, very unusual for Dublin kids, nowadays anyway. But in those days, you know, we would milk cows, fed pigs, fed chickens, tin turnips, our summer jobs were out.
Was Drumcondra nearly like part of the country at that stage?
It was very much so. I mean, all the land, I mean, the last bits of it are left. It was called Holy Land because the Clonliffe College of people with No Crow Park and the huge amount of land that's still there just about. I think it's on the move away now to building as well. And then there was, you know, you had all the orders. You had Redemptorist nuns who are still there. Alphonse's Road, and you had the Carmelite nuns who have now moved to Malahide. So Hyde Park, the Christian Brothers. So all of the land around there was really farming country. And we're talking, I was, you know, I was a kid in the 50s and into the 60s, but it was country then. Only a few miles from O'Connell Street, only a few miles from where we are, and but still a huge amount of land.
What school did you go to?
I went to Pat's, St. Pat's Drumcondra, which wasn't part of the training college, but it was connected, was on the land of the training college, so you always had students. Part of the training for the students in those days was that they came down and did a week. So we always had a teacher in the front of the class and a student in the back, so very hard to do anything.
And what about secondary school?
I went to St. Aidan's CBS in Whitehall.
Is that near...
St. Aidan's is up on Collins Avenue.
Oh, is that wasn't the one near where the old Artane school was?
No, yeah, that's St. David's.
Oh, St. David's.
So what happened was the Christian Brothers opened the school in the early 60s. Most of the brothers came from O'Connell's. It had no name till nearly we were leaving. It was kind of called the O'Connell's Extension, but it was named St. David's, a thriving school now and an excellent school. And a great school for sports. Kevin's boys soccer team, they share the facilities up there now. Whitehall Columbkills Gaelic Club. So yeah, it's a great sporting school.
I actually went to O'Connell's and I played for Whitehall Columbkill, Whitehall Gales as it was
that's
at the time.
That's what it was. That was my club.
So, but how come you didn't go to O'Connell's?
My brothers, what happened was we were in Pat's and this new school was opening. And my brother Morris and brother Noel were in O'Connell's. The new school was open. The Christian Brothers were kind of saying this is the new school up the road. It was all the brothers were coming from O'Connell's and Clostawira, and a lot of the guys in my class who I was playing with were from Lackhill Whitehall. So of course I wanted to go with the yes. buddies, and but it was great. We were lucky because we probably weren't the most orderly bunch of kids that ever were, but the fact that the brothers were setting up the school, they wanted to get the old reputation of it going. There was a good lot of brothers there. Subsequently, they moved on to Swords. And, we got a good and tough education, but I great regard for the brothers. I never said anything against them.
Yeah. So, in that time you were growing up, obviously you were living pretty close to Croke Park and the excitement of seeing people going. Can you remember your first time going to Croke Park?
Yeah, my dad would go down to see any match. Once there was a ball on the pitch and my dad would go. And in those days, there was matches in Croke Park every Sunday. There was no Super Sundays, no Sky Sports, no anything. So we tended to go down for everything from the Oireachtas tournament, the Grounds tournament. All our listeners will remember a lot of those tournaments. So I think one of my earliest memories, we used to go down and watch the first 10 minutes and then I think go playing, around the canal end, and then before we got seriously into the matches. But one of my earliest memories was seeing Kevin Heffernan carried off in his last match. Okay. And I can't recall
what year was that?
That must have been about 59 or 60. Yeah. Kevin won in All Ireland in 58. He was a sub in 63, but it was either it was somewhere in around. They won something anyway. It might have been Vincent's or it was him, but he must have been in the early 60s.
Yeah, very good, very good. Now another question I wanted to ask you, because you would have been around when Nelson's Pillar was still standing. Did you ever go up in Nelson's
Pillar? Yeah, I did. I went up when a few of the country cousins used to come up from Cork. We'd bring them into town, and from a very young age, I'd go into town with my mother, and then I'd go in, go into Moore Street, into the butchers and Moore Street, or into the dealers, and and then I got used to going into on my own. It was just to hop on the bus and Drumcondra to Cat and Cage and into town. So I would be given the job of going in with the country cousins and paying the truppence, as it was in those days, to climb the pillars. I was up the pillar a good few times.
Yeah, I remember someone said, well, it was maybe, was it 3 or 6 old pence or something to go up there?
I think it was, the Sean Allard ages, the brown truppenny bits.
You have a good memory of that
age.
Exactly. So that was in Nelson's Pillar. And then, of course, you obviously remember when Nelson's Pillar blown up and the shock and the whole thing.
I wasn't allowed in to stay up the night that it was. But I was the night after it was officially blown up. I went in the following morning at about 7:30 to collect some rocks and bits of it. So I remember saw that. I went in on my own when it was at 64. I think it was about 12 or 13 or something at the time. But I was into, or was it 66? 66, I think.
When it was blown up?
Yeah, it was
66,
blown up.
66 or 7.
So I was 14 and 15 then.
Yeah, yeah.
But I went in. That was blown up for the 50th anniversary of the Rise. And so it was 66 it was blown up, I think. So it was. I was in to see the aftermath of it. Of course, the joke about that was that there was more damage done on the second blowing up than there was in the first, but yeah. We better not get into that.
No, with the army and everything. So, and it was a funny thing, I remember reading many years ago that someone, I don't know who it was, said that, why didn't they replace the pillar or something, and, they could still put Nelson up there, but it'd be Nelson Mandela or something like that. I could still call it Nelson's Pillar.
There was a bit of a campaign. There was always an objection to Nelson being on the pillar. You read in old history books, but I remember in 63 when Dublin won the All-Ireland and Des Foley was captain, there was a campaign to put Des Foley on top, which I would have been supportive of.
So in those days, musically, what sort of stuff did you listen to, or what music kind of informed you in those days?
Well, I suppose when I went to I remember in Pat's We had a teacher, Mr. Hackett, who was a fanatical, and Mr. Clines, but they were great into ballots, and the Clancy brothers were on the go at the time. And then, of course, it came into the Beatles era. And in my class, it was very much, when we were probably in sixth class, it was when the Beatles, you know, started, or fifth or sixth class. And you either had to be a Stones fan or a Beatles fan, you know, your runner. I was a Beatles fan. But my first bit of music, but my first memory nearly in life that sticks with me, and I don't think I imagine it, because some people say, oh, you're too young to remember. But my first thing was sitting on my mother's knee, being spoon-fed back in Church Avenue. And it was the first song that my mother had me singing. It was That Doggy in the Window, Patti Page. Back in, I think it was 1952. That's Patti Page of the famous Morning Bird Hill. And she, or Mockingbird Hill. And she, I remember that song so well. So that was my big bit of music that I still remember. It was a hit later on, but Patti Page made it a hit in the early.
And I think someone did say it was Margaret Thatcher's favourite song, so...
but I think it was probably what the attraction was for me, that with my mother would sing it, but then you had to bow wow every few lines, so I say it's a baby, because I literally was a baby.
So I'm going to ask you, because we want to take a little pause for some music, I'm going to ask you to choose a particular piece of music. It doesn't have to be that particular song, or it can be whatever.
No, I that one, because it's my first memory. I could take all the Beatles ones that I love so much, but as a child, my first memory was that. How much is That Doggy in the Window? Particularly the one by Patti Page, which is the early 50s.
Okay, we'll have a listen to that.
Is that doggy in the window? The one with the waggly tail. How much is that doggy in the window? I do hope that doggy is for sale.
Sunshine Meets on Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8.
And welcome back to Sunshine Meets. My guest is former Taoiseach Bertie Ahern. Bertie, I'd like to talk to you about the Good Friday Agreement, because a lot of people are talking about the Good Friday Agreement nowadays, particularly younger generation, but a lot maybe don't understand the complexities of it and how it came about and how bad the situation was before that. And just tell us about your part in it.
Well, I suppose it's important where the Good Friday grew out of, particularly for younger people. Like, the trouble started in 68, 5th of October 68 was really when the Civil Rights March turned violent. The old Be Specials just beat into a crowd who were marching for really for housing and health and education policies. It went on into 69, troubles right through August 69, it really got bad. British Army came in then.
Just to explain to people, the B Specials were a branch of the RUC.
The B Specials were kind of set up as a part-time Royal Ulster Constabulary, but they were hated by Catholics and hated by nationalists, and I suppose they were considered to be a bit like tans, the black and tans of people.
And predominantly Protestant.
Protestant, and unfortunately didn't understand or care too much about nationalist areas. And one thing led to another, as always happens, it turned violent. Into the 70s, right through the 70s, the violence was horrendous. Huge amount of bombs, deaths, shootings, continued right through the 80s. The hunger strikes, Thatcher being unrelenting and not giving an inch. And there were a few efforts made over those years to try to find a peace process. There was Sunningdale Agreement, didn't last very long. You know, then there was different efforts made in Garry Fitzgerald and Thatcher. So when it came into the 90s, it was Albert Reynolds. I was part of that government, Minister of Finance in that government. And we decided to change the emphasis. And I suppose, to explain very briefly, the change we made was in the 70s and the 80s, there were genuine efforts made by people. I won't say anything bad about them. They made genuine efforts. The difficulty was that the people who were causing the violence and engaging the violence were not part of the process. The difference that Tony Blair and I did in the 90s, following on from John Major and Albert Reynolds, was to make an inclusive process, to reach out that if people stopped the violence, stopped the killing, stopped the murders, that we would give them a place in the negotiating table. So what was different about the Good Friday Agreement, and I think the reason that it was a relative success, there are still problems, of course, but not really much violence, thank God, was that everybody was in. If you signed up to the George Mitchell principles, who was an envoy of Bill Clinton, that you stopped the violence, stopped the shooting, stopped the bombings, that you would get a place at the negotiating table.
And George Mitchell, just to explain who George Mitchell was.
George Mitchell was a senior American politician, was a speaker of the House of Representatives, and Bill Clinton recommended him, nominated him to come to Ireland to help to chair the multi-party talks, which was all the political parties, 10 political parties around the table. And it was the first time since the trouble started in 68, and in fact the first time since 1921, since partition, that everybody was around the negotiating table to try and work out what was a comprehensive deal to end the violence and try and build a political.
And when you
future.
Say everybody, that included the Provisional IRA.
It included Sinn Féin, who were, you know, as I coined them, the opposite side of the coin to the Provisional IRA. It included the Loyalist parties, Gary McMichael, Davy Irvine, all these characters that people would have heard of, the Women's Coalition, including all of the Alliance Party, the Ulster Unionist Party, the Democratic Unionist Party, the SDLP. Mm-hmm. So all of them had seats at the table. And I think so everybody who was involved were there at the table.
With the exception, maybe, was it the DUP didn't?
The DUP started, but then, as usual, pulled out. It took us several years to haul them in. We didn't. The Good Friday Agreement was negotiated from September 97 to Good Friday 98. And then it took us a number of years. It was another 4 or 5 years before we could convince the Democratic Unionist Party to join.
And to get an assembly. So, and just to explain, how does the assembly work? Because it doesn't work like a normal parliament or a normal Dáil.
No, the Good Friday Agreement, I suppose, for people who wouldn't follow it over the years, I always said there's three legs of the stool, if you think of the old-fashioned stool. One was the internal position in Northern Ireland, the politics of what happened within Northern Ireland. That led to setting up the Assembly and the Executive, which is still being talked about every day because there are problems about that, and hopefully the talks that have just started will get us somewhere on that. The second leg of the stool was the relationship between Belfast and Dublin. The people elected in the north with the people in whoever is in government in the south, and that's the north-south bodies. And the third leg of the stool is the relationship between Westminster and Dáil Éireann. So there are three defined areas of a part of the agreement. And the agreement, what we did in the agreement was included everything. We put in prisoners, we did decommissioning of arms, a new criminal justice system, most importantly a new police force, the PSNI, which took over from the old RUC, an equality agenda. So all the things that were causing problems over the years were tackled and implemented. Of course, we've still have the problems with the executive, but by and large, the structures were all based around those three legs of the stool.
Okay, and of course, the whole thing was rubber stamped by the US government, which was really important as well.
Yeah, and probably even more important was that the fact that the Irish people, north and south, voted on it, and that was the first time since 1918 that the people of north and south on the one day had an opportunity to vote on an agreement. The last time was the election of the first Dáil back in 1918, which we just went through the 100th centenary last year.
So we did, the Assembly, as we speak, is not sitting, but people are hoping that we'll get back together. Now, the threat back in 2016 when the United Kingdom voted to leave the EU. With the exception of possibly people in politics here, a lot of people didn't see that was a threat to the Good Friday Agreement. How did you see it?
I never thought that the UK would leave the European Union. And I have to tell you, I was there for every day of the talks, or every sheet of paper that was ever written in the talks I read. Nobody in their wildest dreams, not even the cleverest or the stupidest people ever mentioned in the talks process, that the UK would leave the EU, because it was just a crazy thing for them to do, but, and I still think it is. we never dreamt of that, but we always thought that the fact that the UK were in the European Union and we were in the European Union, this was a help to the peace process. So obviously, when they decided to pull out, and they have now are going to pull out, that has been bad. So we had to find a new solution, that we didn't go back to the old days of putting a structural border infrastructure on the island of Ireland. And quite frankly, and it's not in any way disrespectful, because I think British politicians realised this after the referendum, we tried to warn them in 2016 that this was going to have implications for the North. And the Kenny went over, I was at meetings, I went to Oxford and Cambridge, I went to Durham University. We weren't listened to, quite frankly. And it was only afterwards then that they realised. And, you know, characters like Rees Mogg and these guys, I mean, they just had no conception of the border. They didn't understand it. They thought it was a wall somewhere. They thought it was a gate on it. They thought it was Brandenburg Gate or something. And it's taken them a few hard years to understand that the island of Ireland has problems.
And a lot of them have never even read the Good Friday Agreement. A lot of the politicians who should know better.
No, I mean, they had, I mean, if you take people that are there now, some of the Tory ministers who have been around in different guises, some of them were journalists back in 1998. I mean, they wrote terrible things against the Good Friday Agreement. They should have known better. But I think at least as we go into the 2020s, we're in a position where they understand the island of Ireland better. Mm-hmm. They understand the Good Friday Agreement better. We've just now got a motion passed in the House of Representatives in the United States.
The Congress,
yeah. Yeah, and the Congress, saying very clearly that any trade agreement that is negotiated between the UK out of Europe and the US will have to give precedence and prominence to the Good Friday Agreement. So that'll put a stop to any of these people that think they can just ride over
it. Well, the executive branch, which is Donald Trump, can't just do a deal. It has to go through the Congress, it has to go through Senate.
To be honest, I think it's cloud cuckoo land. I mean, the idea that Boris Johnson is going to negotiate a total deal in 2020 and have it all wrapped up in 2020 and beat the world record for negotiating deals from usually about 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 years down to 6 months, it just won't happen. I know he said he's going to do it and they fall out, but Boris will do what he's very good at doing. When he gets his way, he'll just change his mind.
Exactly. So just to, before we take the next piece of music, just to slightly go back to the Good Friday Agreement, because it took a torturous year, I suppose, 97 to 98, to actually get everything signed. And personally, you went through losing your mother during that period of time. How did you manage to balance the balancing act there?
That was a tough week. I suppose, like everything, you just keep going. I mean, we had set, George Mitchell had set the ground rules and the parameters for the negotiations, and it was to finish on Holy Week, and everyone had made arrangements for Easter. George Mitchell was going back to his wife in the States. He had been stuck in the talks for weeks. Tony Blair was going to Spain, and I was going back to Dublin, and everyone was going somewhere. So we had a deadline, we had to stick it, and then my mum took bad on the Sunday and died on the Monday morning. So the agenda for the week had been set out. So, you know, as the man says, you just have to do your job. Yeah. And then we had the funeral in the middle of it, and Your Paddy Cole came and kindly played at my mum's mass, which I always remember. And it was Archbishop of Dublin was at the mass, and you know, so it was. And the hard bit for me was, you know, after a funeral, remembering my mum, we all went back to the Skyline Hotel, and the officials had said to me at the graveside, listen, you have a half an hour, you have to get back to the talks. And that was the hard bit. You literally shaking hands to everybody as they queue for the meal and go back to Belfast. Yeah. But anyway, that's life. You have to do your job.
And what was the most difficult part? Because, I mean, there had to be an awful lot of trust from the paramilitaries to get the likes of the UVF, the UFF, the IRA, the INLA, all these people to sign up to it. We know there was some dissidents who haven't still, but it would be a very small minority. But how, I remember many years ago reading in the Irish Times, I think it was Kevin Myers saying, you know, this is folly, this is stupid, you will never, these guys are murderers, you'll never get them to ever give up their arms, this is going to go on forever. And yet it happened.
Yeah, it did. And I suppose, you know, two things. The talks were one thing, and the difficult issues in the talks were, you know, getting agreement on a new police force for Northern Ireland, and that took some years to implement. Chris Patton, a British politician, was a big help to us in that and did a very good job. He was an honourable guy. The prisoners issue was crucial. There was no way we ever would have got the agreement and got all of those who were involved in paramilitary activity in if we didn't release the prisoners. And I worried a lot about that. But in fairness, the release of prisoners was not the biggest problem, because very few of them ever reoffended. They came out on license, and they were actually helpful in stabilising it on the ground. So, but to implement everything took us till 2007. So when we negotiated in 1998, it took us all those years to get there. And you know, it's like peace anywhere is hard won. And I think there were a lot of people worked very hard. And of course, we were lucky that there were great people like John Hume and, you know, Seamus Mallon and David Trimble, who I got friendly with, a difficult guy in the early days, but, you know, built up a relationship. And later on, Ian Paisley, who took me about 12 years of my life before he shook hands to me, but ended up good friends with the family.
How did he suddenly have a change of heart? Like, this was like the greatest mystery of all time to people who, certainly in Ireland, Southern Ireland, Republic of Ireland, you know, Ian Paisley, God.
Yeah, well, I often wonder what my father would have been thinking of me ever shaking hands with him. But anyway, you know, time moves on, and the reality was that it didn't happen overnight, I can tell you. It was long, hard battles. I remember when I met David Trimble first, and I was trying to deal with everyone, told me, oh, he's difficult. And I said, well, he must have some interest. Does he follow rugby or soccer or something? They said, no, he's not into any of that. I said, well, what is that? He's big into opera. I knew nothing about opera. I've been into Wexford Opera Theatre to get the money from your taxpayers' money. And the other thing was waterways. And of course, the only one person who ever did anything in Ireland on waterways was Charlie High, but he didn't like Charlie High, so I couldn't mention that either. So, but slowly but surely, we built up a good relationship, and I must say I had a lot of regard for him. He sits in the Lords now, and I keep in touch with him.
Very good. And of course, today's DUP appear perceptionally to be as difficult for today's politicians. So what would your advice be to the Leo Varadkars and the people who are dealing with the
I think you have to engage. I mean, there's only one way you sort out negotiations. And whether I was dealing with the unions or issues in my parties over the years or some of the things I do today, you know, you have to engage. It won't be resolved by sitting in your office looking at the four walls or looking out the window. You have to get your hands dirty and sit down and take the abuse. And God, I took some abuse. And, you know, it's the only way you'll resolve things. And if you're trying to do something big, as we were trying to stop, I mean, almost 4,000 people have been killed, tens of thousands of people have been injured, billions of pounds worth of damage. You're trying to stop that and build a better future for the rising generations. You have to get stuck in. There is no alternative to that.
Okay, you're listening to Sunshine Meets. My guest this evening is former Taoiseach Bertie Ahern. We're going to pause for some music, Bertie. Your second piece of music is...
Yeah, I'm a huge Neil Diamond fan. I love everything to do with Neil Diamond. I've listened, I've met him a number of times, lucky enough to meet him on his visits here. I could pick 20 of the ones, but when I often sit down, Melody Road is one of my favourites.
Okay, let's have a listen.
I'm on with you all the way to the end.
Sunshine Meets on Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8.
Now, welcome back to Sunshine Meets. My guest this evening is former Taoiseach Bertie Ahern. Bertie, we've covered the Good Friday Agreement, we've covered your early life, and so much has been written about your political life. So you decided to leave politics, was it 2012 around that
time? Yeah, well, I always said I'd go when I was 60, so I went a little bit earlier than I intended in the wars, but I still would have went to, I still would have went in 2012 or around that period. I wanted to try and do other things. I'd been 34 years in the Dáil. I kind of was involved in politics from, you know, from the beginning of the 70s.
Are you the longest running or second longest running Taoiseach after Eamon Devlin?
The only one to beat me was Dev. Yeah. that isn't a bad one.
And then there's the longest living Taoiseach, I think, is Liam Cosgrave. So
Well, I think he got to 98 or something, so that'll be a bit of a stretch.
Exactly. So you've no thought of getting back into politics in any shape or form, or do you, in the form of maybe if Michael D steps down? Have you ever thought about that?
I'd be ancient by the time Michael D finishes. But no, I don't. I don't follow day to day, so I just take an interest like every man and woman in the street, the Joe and Mary soaps, you know, but I follow Brexit and follow international politics more now, and then I follow what my interests are in mainly conflict resolution. And I'm lucky enough for these few years I'm chairing the former presidents and prime ministers from all over the world. They're the oldest group. Is the Interaction Council, and I'm co-chair with President Obasanjo of Nigeria, and for these 3 years I'm chairing that, so that keeps me more than active and busy and interested in things.
Let me ask you about your thoughts of the so-called discourse in the United States and Britain in politics in general, the rise of sort of right-wing politics, and your view of how, I suppose, toxic everything is nowadays. Is it worse or better, or is it has it always been like that?
No, it's far worse in my view, and it is toxic, and it's very unfortunate. I believe that the word that's been used for a few generations, probably since the Second World War, is multilateralism. And multilateralism is that no country can do things on their own, that people should work together and cooperate together. And that's why we have organisations like the OSCE and the UN and, you know, all the other international organisations that people listen to in the headlines and the radio and papers every day. And where people work together and cooperate together and deal with the big problems of the world, whether it's today it's climate change or whether it's disarmament, nuclear disarmament or whatever. And unfortunately, people like President Trump and you know, Erdogan in Turkey, Putin in Russia, they don't agree with that. They are effectively, you know, semi or quasi dictators in one form or another. Some of them are elected, and some of them are elected, you know, in funny ways. So you know, I don't agree with any of that. I think the world's a better place when people are pulling together, working together, negotiating together, trying to deal with the big problems that help the lives of people every day. And people like Donald Trump just don't believe in that, and he's just one of a group. And we're unlucky at the moment that there's a group of them around the world who are all influential people, far more powerful than most people in the world, but they all seem to think the same, and it doesn't help the world, in my view.
Now, you've had conversations with Bill Clinton and George Bush, and What do you think they're thinking at the moment?
I'd say they're fairly horrified. I mean, they you know, I got on really well with Bill Clinton. I keep in very close touch with him. To a lesser extent, George Bush, but I had a great time for George Bush. I didn't go with the view of George Bush. I mean, okay, he tended to have his views on wars and as Republicans tend to have, but he was a good guy. And I still keep in touch with Laura and him. And they are not happy campers. Tony Blair and George, Prime Minister Brown, and you know, any of the guys that I dealt with are not happy with the presidency.
And how can, you know, people who are like George Bush, who are fairly influential within the Republican Party, and yes, would be right wing, but when they see the kind of thing that, you know, the current president of the United States, you know, says and does and has done, and his language and his just his whole demeanor, how can these people not just say, no, this is unacceptable for a president?
Yeah, well, I think as we go through election years, we go through 2020. I think you'll see a lot of people speaking out, and hopefully the problem in the United States, in the normal course of events, you wouldn't imagine that a person like Trump would get elected. But I said 2 or 3 years ago that he could get elected if the Democrats don't pick a candidate and you know, push that candidate, get behind the candidate. Here we are, you know, going into the election year, and here you have them still hanging around with a dozen candidates. I mean, and they're all fighting each other and they're undermining each other. And all Trump has to do is to sit back and see who's the last man or woman standing. It's bad politics, you know. I mean, you know, in politics, you, and particularly today, because it's fairly personality orientated. You watch the way it's been the recent election in Britain, like, and that's the way it is in elections. And here you have, coming into election year, as you start election year, you have Trump on his own, on his pedestal. Well, you like him or don't, I don't. And you have the Democrats with about a dozen candidates can't make up their bloody mind. And you know, that's why, you know, they're making it easy for them, and unfortunately.
Just tell me, before we finish up, Bertie, tell us about, you have a couple of projects ongoing, and there's one at the moment that you're
involved in. I did, last year and this year, I was asked, I'm working with the United Nations on a project in Papua New Guinea. They had a huge conflict in part of Papua New Guinea. Papua New Guinea is about 9 million people, but there is an area called Bougainville. Bougainville had a major conflict over a mine, a copper mine, very wealthy mine. The people didn't feel they were getting a fair share. They rose up against the Papua New Guinea government. There was a war for 8 years. 23,000 people lost their lives. A horrendous war in a place that has a relatively small population, that section of it. And the Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea at the time was Prime Minister O'Neill, whose grandfather or great-grandfather was from Derry.
I was thinking with O'Neill, yeah.
Yeah, so he knew about my involvement in Northern Ireland. He asked me would I become involved in trying to implement the peace process. And the autonomous region is President Momus. He's both of them jointly asked me would I come in to implement the agreement. So I've spent and to try, and the referendum is actually on, and hopefully before Christmas, I'll be there with them, and hopefully we'll get it to that stage.
Very good. Now, before we get your final piece of music, did you get the chance to go to Croke Park for the Dubs 5 in a row?
Yeah, I think I was at every match on the 5-in-a-row run. We played 17 counties. It can't never be said we played 17 counties on the road to get 5 in a row. And it was great. And though I had a holiday in Kerry, it couldn't have been better. As Heffo used to say, you haven't really won an All-Ireland until you beat Kerry. So to have it 5 in a row, beating Kerry in a replay, God, it couldn't be better.
I suppose, and a good time for Jim Gavin to retire. So, can you see the Dubs continuing on a run, or with the new manager? What do you think?
I think it's going to be difficult anyway. It's hard to sustain it. I think it's, you know, people will go, other counties will come up to the plate. You know, new management team in. You know, it'll be difficult enough. And I know people say, oh, there's not anyone great around, but there's very good counties around. I mean, you know, there's Donegal are not that far off. Tyrone are never far off. Mayo, Galway and Cork are coming back again. And of course, Kerry will always be there. Always be there.
And my final one for you, will Man United get into the top four?
very, very difficult. But though it's been a terrible... it's been a terrible 6 years, but I suppose it's like everything. You know, I always say to my grandkids, going to All-Irelands and going to Dubs matches, remember, it will not always be like this. You will not be winning every year. I remember up and down that road, nearly crying after the four in a row, and with Meath in 91 and Tyrone walloping us a few times, Kerry hammering us so many times. 16 years and winning nothing. Yeah. It's been an amazing period. And United probably has it, amazing period. Though I think the policy of having young guys and building up young guys is the right thing. Bringing in fellas at 80 million and paying them, you know, £500,000 a week is nonsense. Yes.
Okay, we're going to wrap it up now, Bertie. Final piece of music.
Yeah, the Neil Diamond and the Bee Gees were my great 1960s and 70s, and I still play Bee Gees music every week, and I love them, and it's only Words, I think, is probably one of my really favourites.
Fantastic. Listen, thank you so much for coming in. I know you have a really busy schedule, but really appreciate you coming into Sunshine, Bertie. Thank you very much.
And lovely to be on your show.
Yeah, thank you. That's former Taoiseach Bertie Hearn, and we say goodnight. Tom Cole Jr. is on the way with some swing music.
Smile, an everlasting smile. A smile can bring you near to me. Don't ever let me find you gone, 'cause that would bring a tear to me. This world has lost its glory. Let's start a brand new story now, my love. Right now, there'll be no other time, and I can show you how, my love. Talk in everlasting words and dedicate them all to me. And I will give you all my life. I'm here if you should call to me. You think that I don't even mean a single word I say. It's only words, and words are all I have to take your heart away. Are all I have to take your heart away.
Sunshine.